You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Tony nominations are announced tomorrow. It's Tony time, award season. You know what that means? It's also Tony party time. I'm sponsoring a big old Tony party. I hope you can come. Invitations will be going out to all members of the Producers Perspective Pro. So check out the producersperspectivepro.com. On to the podcast.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. This is the Producers Perspective Podcast. I am Ken Davenport. I am super excited to have a superstar director choreographer with us today. Please welcome to the podcast Tony Award, Olivier Award, Emmy Award, Drama Desk Award, and Outer Critics Award winning director choreographer Rob Ashford. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, Ken. Nice to be here.
So I first met Rob on what I believe was your very first Broadway choreographer credit, right? On Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Thoroughly Modern Millie was the first.
The first. And he just happened to win a Tony Award for his first show out of the gate, just like that.
I was blessed and lucky, and it was a thrill. Thrill to start out. Plus, it was a great show.
Yeah,
it was a great show to work on, and it was a great group to work with. You know, we did our out of town first in La Jolla, and we were waiting for our theater, waiting to come in. You know, after that, we were doing some work on the show, of course, as you always do. And then 9/11 happened, and our little group, Michael Mayer, Denise Sorey, Dick Scanlon, we kind of survived that time by working on Thoroughly Modern Millie. We got together every week. We had a full day of work session every week to just keep us focused, keep us working, keep us creating. And it made such a huge difference in the show overall, I think, in the final result. So it was a great experience as well as a nice interview.
And done a ton more shows, including directing and choreographing the revivals of How to Succeed, Promises, Promises, Evita, and If You Think You Can Only Do Musicals. While in London, he directed Streetcar Named Desire at the Donmar Warehouse, Anna Christie, and here, Cat on a Hudson Roof, Macbeth. He's choreographed for the Kennedy Center Honor, the Academy Awards multiple times, and also directed and choreographed The Sound of Music Live and Peter Pan Live for NBC. So my first question, it's a doozy. Ready?
Yes.
Is it true you're from Beckley, West Virginia?
It is very true. I am from Beckley, West Virginia.
I did summer stop there.
Did you? What happens in the movies?
No, I did it at the very short-lived West Virginia State Music Theater. Ran for two seasons.
Oh, really? Yeah, we have. That's how I got started in this business. There's an outdoor summer stock theater that does a musical retelling of The Hatfields and the Boys, The Few. And that's 5 nights a week, and 2 nights a week is a kind of a Civil War drama called Honey and the Rock. And they both had musical aspects. They all had dancers, and that was kind of what we all grew up on in my town. That was the only theater we had. And so everybody would go every summer, even though the shows were the same, different cast. That's where I fell in love with.
So you were a performer, obviously.
So then what I went on my summer of graduating from high school, I went to I was very bold. I went to John Benjamin, who was the artistic director at the time, went to his office and basically just asked if I could meet him. And I came in, I was the president of the Thespian Society at my high school, and I love having employees, and I'd love to be in it. And I think he thought that I was so bold that he actually put me in it. As an extra, I made $35 a week. I had a small part in Hatfields. I was one of the McCoy sons, and had a wonderful death scene. Only two lines, but a wonderful death scene. And a small part, one line, in Honey and the Rock. And then my third summer there, first day of rehearsal, one of the dancers didn't show up. And they came up to me and they said, I know you want, but could you possibly fill in for this, we get someone here to take this position? And I said, sure, I would love to, because I had done the show for two seasons before. I knew what the dances were. There was a big funeral dance that was quite dramatic and very Martha Graham that I loved. And so I just stood in until they got a guy there, but actually it came very naturally to me. And they thought I was doing great, so they didn't replace me. And I stayed in that position. And the dance captain who had gone, her name was Tanita English, and she had gone to Point Park College. She came up to me and said, you know, I think you could be a dancer if you wanted. And I said, really? She said, yes, I absolutely do. And I was in pre-law at Washington Lee University at the time. I'd done 2 years for that. And she invited the head of the jazz department at Point Park College down to see the show, teach class, you know, the new stuff.
So wait a minute, because this flies in the face of every convention I've ever heard about dancers. So you didn't start when you were 20 years old. 20 years old as a dancer. Wow.
Well, I had determination, and I never played sports or anything in school, so I didn't have like football muscles or soccer muscles that had to be retrained. I had no muscles. So it was very adaptable to the dancing. So I call my parents and say, I'm not going back to W&L, be a lawyer.
And when you graduated from school, did you then just truck up here to New York?
I came right to New York. I moved here with Kathleen Marshall, she didn't go to Point Park, but her family lived in Pittsburgh. And she graduated from Smith the same time I graduated from Point Park, and her dad practiced in a U-Haul, and we moved to New York.
And obviously started dancing in a bunch of shows,
yes,
right?
Yes, started. I was very lucky. Anything Goes was my first show that I did. It was a thrill to be a part of that. It was an exciting Lincoln Center. It was a very exciting time. And a lot of wonderful energy around that show. So that was fun. That was my first show.
And when did you say, okay, I think I want to start choreographing. I think I can create these things.
You know, I was, at the time when I first, I was in, I'd done a tour of Kisses Spider-Man as a dance captain and swing. We got to work with the amazing Chiba. When they were doing a company, they were setting a company of Spider-Man in Buenos Aires. Rob Marshall, who was a choreographer, couldn't go, and he sent me down to stage the show. So I was down there with Hop Prince in Argentina, and I was restaging all Rob's choreography. So it was a fortunate and thrilling moment because, one, I didn't have to worry about what the steps were and if they were good, because they were really good, and I had been taught what they all meant by Rob himself. So I didn't have any worries about that, but yet I still had all the responsibilities of being the on-site director, of teaching the steps, of trying to teach the acting on top of the steps, to try to help get the acting points across, even with the language barrier. And I fell in love with that process. And then, fortunately, just to solidify it, the same thing happened in Tokyo. They did a company in Tokyo, Rob didn't go, and he sent me. And I was able to do it again in Japan. So those two experiences of being the lieutenant and getting to be on the other side of the table and trying to, and really understanding about acting through dance or trying to understand and trying to teach that really made me excited about the possibility. Came back from that, I went into, thank you, Rob Marshall, I went into Victor Victoria as a dance captain, so I was with Julie Andrews, which was tech. And it was during that, I was swing as well, I was one of the smaller guys, so if you remember the show, but I was being thrown around a lot in 3-inch heels, and my body was just wrecked, you know. So I actually felt like I was losing my love of performing because I was too worried about being injured and getting through it. and so it wasn't so fun for me anymore. So that's when I decided maybe I should try to do the other, at least give it a go.
It's such a pivotal moment, I think, in so many people's lives when they get to a point of they've been doing something for that they started off loving for 10 years, whatever, and they get to a point where they're like, I don't love this anymore. Yeah. And so many people, most people, stay doing that thing and then end up miserable. But you jumped out and...
Well, I was lucky, I have to say, lucky, you know, to know Rob Marshall and his influence and his help. It also helped me. Because after working with him on Spider-Man in Argentina and in Tokyo, when this moment happened for me and I said, I think I'd like to choreograph, and I just went to him and said this to him. And that's when he said, well, I'm getting ready to do this new musical, Gray, Lincoln Center, and I'll speak to, first of all, for Danny Ezra, and the second verse is Pat Burch, and I'll speak to Danny and tell him I want you to be his assistant. You know, and so Hal put me on Gray as an assistant choreographer, first for Danny and then for Pat Burch when she took over for me, and, which was also a wonderful opportunity. And the other thing was, I said to Hal, I want to be a choreographer. He said, show me your voice. Show me. He helped me. He and Brad Rouse, who ran his office, they helped me set up this whole, they did a 2-week workshop of, I created 2 dances. One is kind of a story ballet that was 15 minutes long, 20 people, 20 of the dancers that I was working with, Victoria and Spider-Woman and all my friends, you know, on the street that were in this. And then one short, smaller piece, about 5 minutes, about 4 people. One of the dancers that I knew, his boyfriend was the company manager for Martha Graham. So he got me the Martha Graham studio over at Roll Studio in the 60s on the east side before they tore it down. So we had the run of the studio. And you're sitting in Martha Graham's chair with the Gucci tape beside you. It felt like, you know, very exciting and daunting. So we did these 2 pieces. Hal came. Hal brought some people, brought some casting people, brought some other general managers, brought a couple of other people, whoever would come, another 20 people. And so Hal came and watched me do my first thing and gave me notes afterwards, lots of notes, good ones, very good ones, ones I've tried to always keep in mind.
It's so funny. I was the company manager on that Parade workshop in Toronto.
Oh, Toronto. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, that's right.
And
I was Danny.
Yes. And what's so funny is I remember watching you work because it was a challenging workshop. Many levels.
It was very challenging.
And I remember watching you work through some of those challenges and just, I've had this moment many times in my span in the industry where I've been like, oh, that person is going to be a star. Whether it was Kristen Chenoweth in Steel Pier or this moment, I remember seeing you work going like your mind was just all over it and solving those challenges. All this came back to me right now. So lots of our choreographers in our business have gone on to be director choreographers of musicals, great ones, the Fosse's and Bennett's, et cetera.
Sure.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that it's a natural progression, I think. And I think that, you know, in the search in a musical for a whole, complete whole, and if you're in charge of how a show moves, in essence, as a choreographer, and some more than others, some directors like to have a hand in that, and some love to just hand it to you and have you do it, you know, the more you do that, the more you realize, and if you're creating a dance based on character, well, you're doing all that work anyway, so... Other than, and also if you're lucky and get to work with really good directors, which I got to work with, people like Scott Ellis and John Rando, Mark Brokaw, that included me in the design process, included me in the cast, included me in all of it. And I was inside it with these guys, and they allowed me to be and welcomed me. And so I learned a lot about that as well, and so I'm so thankful for that. They could have kept me out completely. It was just like the music starts here and they quit singing. Now you do the dance and then up. So that was good. It is, if you have any, if you want to try to keep growing, try to keep being better. And so the idea of directing a musical felt like something I wanted to try.
So that progression, as you say, it's natural. It happens a lot. Now, not many of our choreographers of musicals go on to be great directors of plays, which is something you've been able to do. How did you make that transition?
Well, I have to say, again, that, you know, there's always, you know, these great people that, you know, champion you. And mine was Michael Branch. And that was my, the first time I directed a musical, the first time I directed anything was the Don Wilds Parade. And I was choreographing a beat with Michael in London. And I had just done Guys and Dolls with Michael in London on the beat. And he says, you know, you are a director. And I said, I don't know what you mean. He said, you are a director. The way you create the dances, the way you talk to the actors, the way your mind works is a director's mind who happens to be choreographing at the moment. If you were to direct a musical, say, at the Don Mar, where he was the artistic director, and I said, well, the musical that I love the most, that I would love to do, and I feel like, you know, I'd like to get a shot at it, was Parade, because I loved the show, and I believed in it so much, and I felt like it would work. It didn't get the justice it deserved the first time around. So Michael went away and listened to it, and read it, and came back and said, direct Parade, Don Mar, do it. Do your first musical. Direct your first anything. I directed Parade. It went very well and loved doing it and loved the experience. And I said to Michael, and that's when I got offered to do Promises. All the other directing musicals came forward then. And I said to Michael, I can't thank you enough for this opportunity. So there's one way you can thank you, direct your first play here. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I mean, I love Tennessee Williams, of course, because I'm a Southern West, and I love Streetcar, but I can't do Streetcar. He's like, why can't you do Streetcar? I said, I'm a Streetcar. It's my first play, because maybe I should start something else. Maybe something small. Or something that's not Streetcar named Desire.
Neil Simon, maybe.
And he's like, he says, do Streetcar. Do Streetcar. And so then he gave me that opportunity to direct my first play, right on the tail of directing my first musical, and he helped get Rachel Weisz, you know. She played Blanche and Rufus and Stella, and an amazing experience in the trip. They both ended, and that's how that came about. So that was Michael Grandage believing me and giving me that opportunity.
When you work with stars or actors, is your rehearsal room for a musical different than your rehearsal room for a play?
It's the same. It's the same muscles. It's just, you know, like a little discipline. I mean, the only difference between a musical and a play is a lot less. In a play, you're sitting, you know, you don't have a big group up there with you. You don't have musical directors and all of those folks that you would have in the news. That's the same idea. It's the same exact idea. You don't usually have a second room going. You know, usually you are the, unless there's some combat or something like that. We did Macbeth at Manchester Festival and Brown, and then we did it here at the Armory. You know, show started with the battle scene, so there was some side rehearsals going on with that, and we were doing scenes and things. But no, it's pretty much.
What's your process when you create a musical number? Like, I think a lot of people know, a writer sits down to write, or a composer sits down to piano. How do you, as a choreographer, come up with those steps?
The steps are almost the last thing, if not the last thing. I mean, the thing, the fun part. You get an idea and you get in a room with great assistants like I have, Chris Berry, and Charlie Williams, and then you get David Chase, you know, doing dance, and you just sit there and you start exploring it, exploring the characters and the situation intellectually, trying to figure out how do these people move, how do we have their movement define who they are, as How to Succeed, for example, and Promises, both set in offices in the 60s, both in kind of, the difference was the Office of Promises was a, you know, it's a very efficient kind of place, but with a slight push towards this idea of the secretaries, an idea of the dynamic between Sheldrake and Fran, and also with Fran. So it's an interesting dynamic. You want to just like have pepper through there. The same with How to Succeed, creating an office. How does the office move, and then how do people that aren't part of the office move? You just start trying to figure out who are the people that people were watching in films at the time, like Hedy LaRue. Who does Hedy LaRue? Who did she want to be? Who did she imagine that she was? She's Marilyn, you know. So she imagines herself as kind of a Marilyn, and that helped define her move. All those things. And then when you have the music written for you, and you have someone as great as they. Really, you know, pull the themes from the entire score, put it into this and lift this. I mean, it's an exciting, exciting things to do. So that's what we do first, to get an arrangement, and then we go to steps two.
You've been able to pull some great performances out of some big stars. You just talked about the Olivia for Rachel, and of course, one of the greatest star performances I've seen in recent years was Daniel Radcliffe in How to Succeed, because it was so unexpected and he was so fantastic. Is there a secret to working with stars of that magnitude?
Well, I think that, you know, the thing is that, one, you have to want to work, and then you did. And then you just have to, you know, it's always bespoke. Everything's bespoke. Everything is make it for them, create it for them, because the most important thing is that they look amazing. It's not about you looking amazing. And I say, that was the thing, too, after doing Streetcar with Rachel. And one thing she says, she goes, I was worried at first, you know, you coming from a choreographic background, that you were going to choreograph the show. She goes, and it wasn't like that at all. It was actually kind of just the opposite. She said it was actually very free. But, and I think it helps in plays that we've been a choreographer, because I make up a dance in the studio for Daniel Radcliffe or Charlotte Dunbar. It doesn't matter. Whichever one, you know. And if Charlotte's left leg kicks better than her right, then why would I insist on the right leg? Same with Daniel. If he spins better to the right, and even though in the room we made it up to the, we made the spins to the left, let's change to the right. Because he looks good, too. Or maybe he doesn't look good at spins at all, we'll change completely. Because what's the point? What does it mean? Why do that? Why play that power game with them and have them not at their very, very best? So when we talked to Daniel about doing it, and we did a little reading of it, and he said, and so that's the only thing I'm telling you, I'll work on the singing, I'll work on the act. I said, I can't believe it. I can't. I said, someone's as physical as you are in your body as you have to swim. You've been studying with someone for months. You had him on set for a lot of water. He came out twice a week or something for class. And I said, I think you're with the wrong person. So I hooked him up with one of my associates in London, because he was shooting at the time, and started working with him. And I got a text from Dan a month later that says, I was wrong. I think I can. And so what we did was, but again, to try to help him, because he was anxious about that, and I wanted him to walk into rehearsal completely confident in that part. That was the part he was the least confident. And so we did his choreography first. We did it early. We worked on it. We videoed it. We sent it to Spencer, who was there working with him in London. And Spencer worked with him. Spencer would report back, and we'd video report back, and we could see, okay, the spins are better left, not right. We'd switch it up. We'd change it. We'd send the note. And so he came into rehearsal with all his dancing. And that's not normally how we would do it. We would teach him ourselves and teach him in the room. But because I felt like this is something that you don't want to put a stumbling block, you want to come in with your confidence. And you know what? First day we taught Brotherhood of Man, and there he was leading it for the company, for these incredible dancers. There he was, right in the middle, doing it, and doing it with confidence that he won them all over, not that they needed him anymore. And he won himself over.
It establishes him as the company leader,
yeah,
for sure.
All of that. You just need to think of all that. You need to think, you know, all that matters.
So smart. There's, I mean, obviously a big part of psychology in what you do with these folks and with the entire productions.
You know, I was a dance captain in Broadway show. You learn how to deal with people. People as individuals, not on mass. You know how to give notes, and you know how to get what you need out of people. It's something you learn from being a dance guy. So that was invaluable now. You know, knowing how I give you a note and how I give someone else a note, completely different. And it's not belittling to me, or it's my job. So it takes a little more energy to give a certain person a note, and that they need a little bit more, you know, protection than do. As long as they're going to do the best out there.
You said something that maybe want to ask you about again, about your play versus musical process. Obviously, as a choreographer, you create those dances, you get everyone in the room, you teach those dances. When you're directing a play, do you create the staging in advance? Do you say, I'm going to have her cross here, go to the bed?
I have a very basic idea, and that's usually based on, I often think of directing a scene like a ski run, and I think of flags. There's some flags along the way. So, like, what I would do is, let's say in Streetcar, I would say to Rachel, I would say, you know, the entrance is down right, whatever. I'll set all those rules. You know, that's the door, that's the street, that's all that. And then then I just say, it'd be great if when you tell her about Belle Reve, you were at the table. And it would be great if when Stanley enters, you by that column. Just those ideas that I think. And then when you give them three or four flags, then they will just work their good actors, will just work their way around.
Do you read reviews?
I do read them. I read them. I usually read them in hindsight, and I don't mean like years, but like maybe not in that moment, like not that night of it. Because I've learned it's just I just want to try to stay in that moment with everybody. I mean, I have great friends and even some people that let me know. I know what's going on. I'm not oblivious to it. And I trust them completely. And they tell me, you know, you should do Daniel, you should give so-and-so, you should whoever it is that might need that attention. And then I kind of take it from them, and then, you know, a week or two later, and I'll meet them. I think there's something to them.
Has that always been the case? Were you find when you just started and you were younger, were you reading them like,
yes.
Oh God, I got to see what the challenge are saying?
Yes, I was. I did. Yeah. It's it puts you off balance. And then it was just trying to also, if I was going to do that, then I also had to take everything else that other people, it got really out of whack, you know, in our town particularly. It's different in London. London helped me understand the balance of all that.
What's the biggest change you've seen in the industry over the last couple
of
decades?
It's changed. I mean, one thing that I do recall it was back in the beginning, back in the early days and all that. I do know that it was tough to get a theater, but I don't remember that. How it was. I don't remember all that. And the idea of queuing and waiting for years to get one of the three theaters and the power of those guys who hold those cards and doing deciding and the people decide every bit of it, whether it's on win or whether it's on market research, focus groups, allegiances. I have no idea, but no one said, when we were doing Millie, no one said,
who's Millie?
Does she have an Oscar? How many Oscars does she have? How many Emmys does she have? That wasn't like that. So who's going to be really good as Millie?
And thank God they didn't say that, because look who they
found
out of that. Would have had a certain Oscar if there was
exactly.
A Emmy or an Oscar requirement.
Absolutely. So I don't remember that then. I just remember it was about finding like great people. And of course, if you were lucky enough to, you know, have a show that interested in Suda Pala, how great to have her in it. I mean, I'm not negating that at all, but it just didn't seem to be this crazy focus on. Mm-hmm. And I think we're being educated by television and film and all that. We can get any of that anytime we want now. So I think we're becoming a bit more discerning about choosing what we like. So I think that for people like yourself and people like me, the creatives, the producers, it's up to us to not wait for journalists to tell the world what our show is. It's up to us to tell the world what our show is and be clear about it, to be strong about it. And and that's something I learned, you know. You just mentioned earlier that I've done the Oscars a few years, and Craig, Clayton, and Neil Mayer, when they started producing the Oscars, they asked me to come and do the staging of the Oscars for them. And I learned a lot from them in that, because I think the way that it had always seemed, the way it worked in the past, I know it there, but that you wait for the nominations to come out, and then you figure out what your show is. What Neil and Craig said was, let's work on the show. Let's create the show. And then we know there'll be nominees, and we know that things will plug in, and we know what the awards are, and we know that, okay, then that can switch that, and maybe we'll get that person here because they were. But not to wait to do the show. And then we started working on the show in October for a show in February, designing it and creating the numbers and who we want to have as the musical guests and all of that kind of stuff. And that's proper time to create a show, because we had to decide what the show was going to be. We didn't wait until the nominators decided what the show was going to be. They decided who was going to be nominated, but we decided, Neil and Craig decided, along with their team, who was going, what the show was going to be. That's wise, and I think we can take that lesson in our business. Mm-hmm. Let's us be very clear about what the show is.
So speaking of film and television, when you were first approached about directing Sound of Music, what was your first thought?
Well, first thought was the live part, not scary at all. That was the part that everyone was so anxious about. You know, it's going to be live. You know, we do live all the time. And also, we do the time that it matters the most. You know, I've done the Tonys for so many years, the Oscars. Those are live, and then those are in this moment. So I'm used to focusing on all that, and that part doesn't scare me. People making mistakes, that idea doesn't really scare me. It was the logistics of it. It was the idea of staging and rehearsing an entire Broadway musical, you know, the first year of Sound of Music, we were in, like, the most inappropriate rehearsal space imaginable. And it's just because no one really knew what it was. Second year, for Peter Pan, we got a proper rehearsal space where we could actually theoretically go from set to set and get a sense of how to travel. This idea of creating an entire show in a room, in a rehearsal room, which is the idea, but without capability and none of that in the rehearsal room. I mean, I created it with ideas in mind, shots in mind, focus in mind, but it's not done exactly the same thing. And then going out to this soundstage and kind of starting all over. And so the logistics of all that was strictly along with, you know, a whole different set of rules. And not just the network rules and people like actors rules. And it's all set up for a whole different thing. It was cheaper. I mean, for some reason by the rules. And it has to do with featured players and all this stuff. For some reason, it was a lot cheaper to rehearse four nuns at a time than five. So is there any way we could rehearse the nuns four at a time instead of five at a time or 20 at a time? So we had 24 or whatever we had. It was just kind of like, I mean,
I'm trying to imagine your face when someone said, just do four?
Yeah,
just four at a time, please.
But they're just following their rules. That's just the rules they work under. And it's just the, you know, and so all the logistics. I mean, it's a challenge. I was up for it. I was up for the challenge. And also because it was Craig and Neil, and I knew they knew what they were doing. And I knew that they would be able to help. I knew that we would get there in the end, that they were needing us. And I think that I learned a lot between the first one and the second one. And I don't know if it's suddenly part of that beginning for pioneers.
Was it that night? Was it scary?
I think when we pulled into the parking lot, either that day or the day before, that's the spare generator in case the whole complex goes down and we can turn it. Just the idea of it having to happen at that moment, that kind of stress thing, and also the weird thing of it being the big night and being the same people that we've ever known before. Everything's exactly the same, except this is the one that you see people do.
Advice for directors starting out today, some 20-year-old that's never danced before, getting into the business.
Yeah. I said, you know, don't be afraid. And if you're afraid, that's good, because I think being afraid is what keeps us growing and keeps us getting better and taking on more challenges. And I would say that, you know, there's no secret formula. It's just finding what you have to offer, what you like, what your interests are, what your loves are, and just try to, you know, cultivate those and to get yourself in there. I think that it's very different. That's one difference between, there's so many differences between working and their pros and cons to both. But they're all pros, which is different, is that we feel here, or I think our younger folks here feel like they have to wait so long before they get their chance. And I feel like when the younger folks, well, I think they get a chance, they make a chance happen. And I just think that we need a bit more gap here. We need to get the younger folks here starting out, I think, more of an opportunity, more of a chance. You know, and not maybe to only rely on those 8 or those 10.
Okay, my last question, which is my James Lipton-like genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you, knocks on your door, and says thank you for your incredible contributions to the theater, to film, and television by granting you one wish. What's the one thing that drives you so crazy about Broadway? That gets you angry, would have you throwing things at a room, so mad that you'd ask this genie to wish away the one thing?
I think I would wish for all of us working in the business to trust your own instincts, trust your own likes, don't be sheep.
I couldn't have said it more succinctly myself. That is just a perfect way to end this. Thank you very much for being here. And thanks to all of you for listening. You heard it from Rob Ashford. Go out. Do not be cheap. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
So check out theproducersperspectivepro.com and hope you'll celebrate with us. I'm gonna be a producer.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.